Well, it is a great pleasure in Folkestone to meet for the second time, not in Folkestone, admittedly, but Leo Batchelor.
Hello.
Hi. And so we were talking film, of course, last time we met on KMTV on the Film Club. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm really keen to do is to find out all the other things, of course. As we know, your four favourite films, which we may reference here. But it'd be great to get a sense, Leo, about your life and career journey.
Okay, yeah. Yes. It feels like it's been a very wiggly journey.
Yeah, now that's an interesting one, isn't it? So, yeah. Because, and I assume you don't mean just in the last 3 weeks, but this is the entire tapestry of your life.
Yes. Looking back now, and I'm at a stage now where that wiggliness makes sense, and all led to the different elements, but at the time, going through it, it's the classic, okay, I don't know quite what I want to do with my life, but found it by bumping into things and discovering things I didn't expect.
Is this that thing, it's a term that I would call retrospective causality, mm-hmm. whereby sometimes when you're on a journey, you don't know where it's going and you're floundering, and we all do that. I mean, it's easy, you know, when you're a university student, you have no idea how well you're going to do, and so you're worried, you're anxious. When you get the degree that you want, and maybe then a career starts, you look back and think, yeah, it was great, I had a lovely time, because there's that sense that it all sort of fitted into place. But at the time, you feel you don't want to be complacent, and when people say, oh, it'll all be fine, you're thinking, no, but you don't really know what I'm going through.
Yeah.
On the other hand, of course, there's where you are now, looking back mm-hmm. on everything, and whether sometimes you think, oh, it was all meant to be, even when you started going in directions that maybe you didn't think at the time were necessarily felicitous ones, it all kind of plays out. Or maybe we want it to, we're imposing a causality on that. Does that fit in your case?
Yeah, I think there's definitely all the different elements all make sense. I think how I always see it is, I guess I've always felt unclear about what I want to do. I knew the things I was passionate about, and I was always kind of very driven, but I also felt like I didn't have a, this is what I want to be, and this is what I didn't want to do with my life. But I think where that is lacking from a, let's say, kind of in your head, I think in my, I don't know, my heart, maybe it's even in my gut, I think I've always, looking back, I've always been quite good at following my gut and following my instinct, in the sense of giving things a go, and feeling, okay, right, there's an element of that that I enjoy and that I like, but that's not quite it. And at times, and to be honest, until very recently, I often felt, oh, am I just constantly going to be this person that's ping-ponging around from different things? And in my head anyway, I think from the outside, there's definitely kind of categories, and it probably makes sense more to others. But for me, those little nuances of bouncing around and thinking, oh, maybe I'm just scatty, maybe I just get bored. But actually, now I'm starting to hit the place where it's like, no. All of my U-turns and changes in direction were absolutely me being true to myself. But I'm the sort of person, I don't know in advance if it's what I want to do, and then I do it. And I'm like, great, I've loved this, but it's not quite it, but I've learned from it, and it's put me on my next path. So I'm a experiential learner and liver, I guess.
Well, it's worth saying that one thing you did, of course, when we did the TV programme, is that you came into the studio, you were filming me filming you. but that whole thing, there's something in that, because there's something about persona. I mean, I remember when I was at university 30-odd years ago, if one of my lecturers was, of course, we didn't have social media then, but if they were to go on social media and film themselves, certainly, I mean, I go to the cinema regularly, and you see me outside, you know, outside the film poster, and then it'll be like, you know, then the review will follow. I think I would have found it very odd if somebody in a position of authority, should we say, was doing that kind of thing, because it just feels like something that maybe somebody younger would be doing. The funny thing is that when you do something, you realise that actually maybe it's just it's an obvious expression of your personality, which is, to other people, like I've been in touch with people who went to school or who listen to me when I do my radio programme, and they're like, yeah, this is exactly what we knew back then you should be doing. And you're almost like thinking, really? Like,
why didn't you tell me?
Yeah. Did you not know? And you're thinking, well, yeah, I did. Because it's about putting it into practice.
Yeah.
It's that disconnect between having a goal, having a dream, and actually doing it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel I'm doing that kind of thing, or at least I'm on that journey. But there, you know, when you've been doing the same job as I have for 20-odd years, the idea that you're suddenly going to change profession and immediately slot into something new, of course it's going to take time. So I can identify with that. But do you think that the whole persona thing, which we get to cultivate. Mm-hmm. You know, people who don't know us will see, you know, people will think, gosh, look at Chris. He's going to different cinemas every night. He's interviewing people. Mm-hmm. He's going on TV. He's going on radio. There's, you know, he's writing all these film reviews. And I guess that people must form all sorts of impressions about the sort of people that we are, which may or may not quite match the actuality.
Yeah, I think I definitely get that sense because, you know, say being a presenter, people see me online. I think I'm definitely, I am who I am on camera is who I am in person. The difference is I just don't obviously film everything because it's not realistic. And I think what people, in terms of my persona that people will see versus what they don't see, is they'll see the part of me that's comfortable and excited to share things on camera. Whereas I guess the flip side to that and the stuff they don't see, but is like the narrative that goes through all of my work and all of my life, is the times where I'm not clear on what it is I want to say, and therefore I don't speak up, I don't share, I'm not, because I'm working out what it is that I want to say. It's a bit like when you have a brand new idea for something, you can't articulate it. It's this amorphous, weird, higgledy-piggledy thing that you don't even know what you think, let alone being able to say it. And so none of that gets shared online, but people see this, so they think, oh, you're always really clear and you're always doing this great thing. It's like, yeah, but you don't see A, the hard work that goes in behind the scenes, and B, the processing that goes on to be able to then step on camera. So it's not a hiding, it's just a, that's the reality. You know, you, it's like when you're presenting, you've spent some time developing, thinking about your script so that you can be clear when you step on camera. So I'd say it's less of a persona and more of the, that's the reality of communication.
But also, of course, it can sometimes be a persona that matches the self that we want to be. I mean, sometimes I notice that I come across in a very sort of jolly, happy way. And I think that probably is my character. But of course, there's also a part of me that thinks, gosh, you know, you worry. You know, I will worry about, you know, if I've got a big batch of marking to do or something, you know, then that sort of makes me think, right, I've got to blitz through this, I've got that to do. And you think of all the sort of things you have to do. But then suddenly, when you're in creative mode, mm-hmm. it's almost as though it's the counterpoint.
Yeah.
That there's something inside that says, okay, you're doing something that you really want to do, you do it well. And it's almost a way of compensating for the fact that, you know, the alternative is the worry, the anxiety. So you flip it. Mm-hmm. And actually that on-air persona is the best form of therapy that there can be, yeah. because you're effectively managing to not just do the things and say the things that you want to be, but also you're entertaining, stroke, educating other people yeah. in the process. And they feel, and, you know, I'm familiar with your posts, and that sense of optimism, that sense that you're excited about something.
Yeah.
You must get good feedback on that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And that's, yeah, it's just being, and you say about the therapy, like, you know, I do a lot of work helping people get confident to get on video or in public speaking. And, you know, people try and get good rather than I say, no, you got to flip it around. You got to get on camera. And, you know, this might not be something you publish necessarily, but get started. And when you look at it and you don't like who you see and who comes across, you know, in who you're being, great. That tells you that's not you, because it feels uncomfortable, it looks wrong, you're like, I don't like it, I don't like that person I see, which tells you you're trying to be someone you're not. Versus, I always think, if I don't like what I see in myself when I'm presenting, it's telling me I'm trying too hard or I'm trying to be something I'm not. Whereas now I can watch videos and it doesn't bother me at all watching myself on video, and often I enjoy it because it's the fullest version of me in a way. Whereas when I first started making videos, you know, I didn't hate it as much as some people do, but it was still a little bit cringy because I was trying and I was like, hi, I'm so, you know, and it's like who you think a presenter should be. Whereas, yeah, being on video, or more likely watching yourself on video, is about self-acceptance of who you kind of really are. And the reason I really enjoy it, it's not a, I completely get what you mean about that. You've got other things going on in your life and all sorts. But that's why I like presenting, is because it forces me to be really present. Because if you're not present, it comes across and you forget your lines. And, you know, you, especially when you're interviewing someone, you have to kind of really listen to what's going on. Everything's heightened. So it's a bit like, you know, when you do extreme sports, you have to focus. Otherwise, you could potentially die. you don't die when you present, but, you know, it's that same heightened anxiety for some people. And therefore, I'm in the moment and I forget all about my worries and other things I've got going on the rest of the day.
Actually, that's a really good way of putting it, because when I was presenting a show about 3 weeks ago, beginning of August, I'd literally just the day before been moving office. And I had to use a porter's trolley, and I was moving across campus. The wheel came off the trolley, literally. All the books fell, grazed my leg. You know, humiliating. You know, that sort of thing. You're more worried, actually, that people have seen you, you know, lying in the road. People think, you know, Chris, what's he done? Then I'm on the radio the next day and making fun of it and laughing at myself. Now, at the time, I was mortified. I was embarrassed and also annoyed, because all I wanted to do was just move some books from an office to the car. And I thought, you know, it's only a couple of hundred yards. And I think I piled the trolley a little bit too high. So, of course, everything went everywhere. And, of course, you're picking everything up, putting it back on the trolley and just trying to hurry to the car with a very squeaking trolley. But suddenly and one of the songs I played was Elton John, I'm Still Standing. And I thought, well, actually, maybe I should have played, I guess that's why they call it the bruise. You know, and I was thinking, but where's that coming from? So it's turning something, you know, negative, but in a way that if it wasn't for that radio persona, there wouldn't have been the outlet for that. There wouldn't be the channel for that. All it would be saying to people, oh, the wheel came off the trolley. And then you start complaining and you're thinking of all the things that have gone wrong.
Yeah.
But suddenly you're in another mode, and then finding songs that match the moment and then inviting the audience. So do you have a similar, you know, a DIY disaster or something? Yeah. Suddenly you realise that actually that's the most cathartic thing that you can do.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I have to ask as well, because when you mentioned that you watch your old, you will watch your most recent ones, and I'm sure you're very happy with them. But when I started doing TV presenting a year or so ago, at the time I thought, yeah, you know, I'd never done this before. I thought, this is quite good. I didn't know I could do this. But because I've been doing this now for quite a while, when I watch those earlier ones that at the time I thought were quite good, I'm like, stop it immediately, because all my intonations are wrong. And I'm doing the introductions, that, you know, I'm saying something that's slightly different. You know, now I've sort of perfected it.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe I was trying too hard, because I don't know the films that the guests have chosen, but in the early days I did. So sometimes I might think, oh, I'll just read up on that, and maybe not so much show off, but to show that I know something about the films, I'd then not so much be allowing the guest to flourish and talk about their favourite film. What I tended to do was perhaps say, well, actually, this is my take on the film. What do you think? But I've got about 5 minutes, so that's not always the most productive way of doing it. And looking back, I wouldn't do that now. And I think maybe I'm just more comfortable in what I'm doing. But do you find that you sometimes don't like to watch something that you may have done a while ago, because you realise that you've finessed, you've fine-tuned your presentational technique, and you've sort of moved beyond that, and maybe ever so slightly even a bit embarrassed about it? Does that ever happen?
A little, yeah. I think you can't not watch back stuff back and cringe a little bit. I found a really old video that I'd done. Someone had challenged me, and it was at a networking event. And so, yeah, it was cringy, but I don't cringe. Yeah, I don't cringe at myself in the sense that, like, yeah, I was a beginner. It's a bit like, you know, looking back at, say, you play golf and kind of chastising yourself when you had just in your first 6 months of playing golf. It's like, well, you were a beginner. Of course you were rubbish. It's the same. I'm like, I was a beginner. I can't beat myself up, because that got me to where I am now. And good on me, old me, for getting on and doing it, even though I didn't really know what I was doing. So, yeah, it's embarrassing in the content, but the context I absolutely am not embarrassed by, because I'm very much a learn by doing person.
Yeah. Although then again, I've sometimes read stuff I've written, and maybe a while, sometimes you might think, oh, I don't like this at all. But sometimes I've read books that I wrote maybe a while ago, and I think sometimes, gosh, this is, you know, where's this going? I think, well, I wrote it, but, you know, sometimes when you have that distance from it, sometimes you look back and you think, actually, in hindsight, this actually works. But you have no idea at the time. But we were our own worst critics sometimes.
Yeah.
I can mark students' work and, you know, decide that this is in this band or that band and give it a grade. But when it comes to your own work, you sometimes might think it's really good, or you might actually think this is awful. What if my students read it? They'll be embarrassed. So there is that sense sometimes that we need critical distance. So that must be something as well that's part of the presentational I use the word persona, maybe persona is not the right word, because that suggests that there's some other kind of entity out there that we're being.
Persona is a bit, for me, feels a bit like something you put on.
Yeah.
Rather, but I get what your point is.
But also I agree with you that actually the bit that I hear on air, I'm thinking, yeah. So it's like that old Woody Allen line when he says, if only life could be like this. Sometimes I'm thinking, yeah, the answer is do more radio. If you like the radio persona, the answer is do more and more of it, because then everything else will crystallise around that rather than that, you know, there's no performance and actually there's no effort involved, because it just, there's a natural kind of sense of this is how I communicate. You can't contrive it. It has to, you know, or at least the contrivance is the experience. You've got to where you are. So you don't have to start from scratch each time you present.
Yeah. And for me, that's what I enjoy about the journey of presenting is more and more just becoming myself more and more, that I can become more and more relaxed, that this is me, and whatever comes up I will respond, and I think that's why a lot of people freak out when they have to do presentations or do media interviews, because they're thinking they've got to be a certain way rather than just be yourself. And it's really about building a trust in yourself that whatever I say I know is true in the moment. And I may listen back and go, okay, well, that wasn't the best answer, but it was true to me in that moment in time. So I'm never going to be too harsh on myself in that sense.
You just reminded me that I used to have a lot of students who'd be really awkward, would do everything they could to get out of doing presentations in class. And then a few months later, I'd get a reference request. They want to be a teacher. And I'm thinking, gosh, that's the last thing.
Yeah.
That I would ever have imagined they'd go on to do. And some of those are now very experienced and very good. And I know sometimes the pupils of those, you know, the former students of mine who are now in teaching, and they say, yeah, brilliant teacher. And I would have thought, well, obviously I don't tell them what I'm about to say now, and you know, it's not naming names. But occasionally you'd think, you know, they're the last person I'd imagine in a teaching capacity, because they would never give presentations, they would never speak in class, they'd actually actively avoid it. But maybe that's part of the process, that they're actively avoiding it, but at some point they have to face it head on, and maybe they think, well, if I want to be a teacher, I have to do this.
Yeah.
So they force themselves into that. So when I met them, they were at an earlier, more, you know, embryonic stage of their development, and then, and of course I only see them for those 3 years between the age of 18, 21. It may be that at the age of 24, 25 or whatever, something has clicked into place, and they've now matured, developed, as I would have done. The things I'm doing now, I couldn't have done 30 odd years ago.
Yeah.
Not just because the technology is not there, just because I don't think I had the confidence to be able to execute it.
Yeah. I'd also say, and this is a lot of the stuff I find fascinating in the work when I'm doing more on the coaching side of work, is around people's relationships with different types of presenting. So standing up to do a presentation on in one of your subjects at university, for example, maybe there's something in that, you know, I remember having to do a report. It wasn't a presentation, but a report about like aeroplane rivets. And it was like, I don't give a damn about that. I have no excitement or context, so I wouldn't want to do a presentation on that. Whereas another subject that I am passionate about, and I love helping, seeing other people where it clicks for them, my relationship with that content is very different. Therefore, I want to stand up and teach other people, whereas I don't care. Maybe I feel imposter syndrome that I'm not an expert on aeroplane rivets to be able to stand up and do a presentation on it. And so for me, it's got nothing to do with standing up and speaking and standing up and delivering and presenting, and everything to do with the relationship with the content, both the specific content that they're saying, but also their role in it. Because maybe doing a presentation to get a mark, for example, will feel very different from standing up and presenting to empower young children, you know, in a deprived school that you really believe have got potential. You know, there's a huge different level of you know, you could say your why or your what's behind that. And for me, that's what makes the difference for people about when they can present and when they can't present, is their relationship with what they're saying.
Yeah, and I was thinking actually that there was a time when somebody would give maybe their first ever conference paper, and they're thinking, right, I've got half an hour. And so they make it dense, they put everything in, they want to show in those 25 minutes or so that they're an expert in this area and that they've done all the work. And what ends up happening is that they don't think about the presentation, they just think about the content. Whereas the person listening, who might be on their seventh or eighth presentation of the day, and really will remember and be maybe more impressed by the delivery than by the content, because it may be Aeroplane Rivets. Somebody could do a talk on Aeroplane Rivets and I might be riveted because they presented it in such a way. Whereas somebody might give a technically precise answer, but I just don't, and I've switched off the moment they've started speaking.
Yeah.
Or somebody could speak on an area that I'm passionate about and I just think, you know, the delivery here is what's stopping this being interesting. It's not communicating to me. So I think that's another thing that you learn as well, the idea that you just present something that maybe on paper is perfect. If you're reading it, there's a level of precision that you're looking for. But if it's a conference paper and you're reading it out, you kind of don't want that. And I've learned that over the years when people would say, particularly if I was with an audience whose first language was not English, they might sometimes say, can you slow down a bit? And I'd often find that quite hard because I was in my sort of mode, but almost forgetting that there's that disparity between what you're saying and how you're saying it.
Yeah, definitely. But part of that also comes down to that, it's still your relationship in a way, though, still, isn't it, in like how you deliver it? Because like you said, that someone who packs it full of information because they want to come across as clever, rather than they could deliver the same content but just really strip it back, but they can't because their relationship with it is, I'm the expert and I've got to be right and I've got to look knowledgeable, versus, okay, this is, what do I want them to get from what I've done here versus I'm trying to look good?
And I have to ask you, because you touched on this earlier, you know, how the journey started. You mentioned the security. I think meandering was the word that you used, or the sort of, you know, the journeys where you don't quite know where they're going. Do you want to say a little bit to you about, you know, where you're from and something about where your perhaps younger self might have expected the journey that you're on to be taking you?
So I grew up in Folkestone. I guess my passion, I was always drawing and painting and stuff as a kid. I was always doing lots of sport because my mum was a PE teacher and my dad was a ski instructor. But I was also good at maths. And I think my whole family was a bit weird because no one else was good at maths or anything. So I always had this kind of weird split mind, it felt like as a kid, and especially as a teenager, it felt like I was like split in multiple different ways, like which route do I go down of my life, because maths on one side and art on the other, like how the hell do you decide which route you go down? And then the sport as well, that didn't work and didn't fit in any of it really. And so, you know, I wanted to do all sorts of, like, you know, maybe I thought, oh, be an interior designer, what other stuff? I can't even remember that. An artist, you know, all those different things. And then I remember a career guidance person at school saying, oh, you could do, you know, there's a course called sports engineering. And I was like, oh my God, that's suddenly the perfect, because design and technology was like the middle ground between the art and the maths. And then I could do it in the subject sport that I'm interested in. So that was where I went, the route I went down in terms of degree, and did it. Well, I didn't do sports engineering in the end. I did product design and engineering, but at Loughborough Uni. So, you know, I just chose all my projects to be sports-based because I was meant to go to Bath and they changed the course on the because I did a gap year and they changed the course in that time. So I switched unis and went to Loughborough, which I'm so glad I did in the end because it was amazing.
There are those sliding doors moments, aren't there? You think, what if? What if they hadn't done that? I had a friend who was going to do a master's up in Newcastle, and then literally like 2 weeks before the start of term, they said, sorry, the course isn't going to run, or at least the modules are not going to run.
Yeah.
And she said, well, if you can't do, I think it was like New Testament, then she said, I don't want to do it. So she, in her case, it wasn't a case then of saying, oh, I'll go to another university. She just didn't do a master's and then followed a different path entirely. So, you know, she might have followed an academic path, but didn't. But it's down to those unknowns, the things that you've got no control over.
Yeah.
But Loughborough obviously worked out for you.
Yeah. And it was similar in the sense they were both engineering degrees. It was just the Bath one had changed from being sports engineering to being mechanical engineering in the first 2 years, and then you only specialise in sport in the third year. And I was like, I didn't want to do design mechanical engineering, whereas the design engineering was, you know, and they were training us up to be a manager of a design team because we did a bit of everything. We did electrical, which I hated, and program. Those are the two I could not do. But everything else, you know, you do chemical, you do manufacturing, you do design, you have to learn CAD, you have to do physics, the whole lot. But it's good to get a little bit of of the kind of the full range, really.
Yeah, Aeroplane Rivet. So almost when you were talking exactly. there, I thought this is going. Yeah. But isn't that interesting? Because sometimes we don't know. I mean, I made a decision to do theology at university. Absolutely the right thing for me back then. But looking back, and in terms of my own children, you know, I mean, they're not going to, it's a high, they're mostly primary school age at the moment, but it's highly unlikely, I would imagine, based on what I see, that they would do anything equivalent to what I've done, who knows it. But isn't it interesting sometimes that you make a decision, but it's what you then do with it. And I found that I did that degree in theology, but all the work I'm doing now in media has kind of been, and obviously unexpected, because you're looking at research areas that I didn't know existed back then, but which, with the background in a subject area, I was able to find a way through other disciplinary studies, and my work on film, you know, came out for PhD that I did. So that's why I used that term retrospective causality earlier, because at the time you don't necessarily know where it's going to take you, but you kind of feel that, you know, in your case, if you'd gone to Bath rather than Loughborough, you would have done something different, but maybe it would all worked out in some way the same way. I'm kind of a believer in that.
Yeah, I am as well. There's this inbuilt thread, isn't there, that's guiding us through, and we can't see it. And we maybe get there from different routes, but it's always going to be the same thing, really. I think I would have ended up in a similar sort of place.
Connecting with people from your past, I find one of the most exciting, because people who knew you at an earlier stage can sometimes have really got a good sense of who you, or at least who you were at that point. I'm always intrigued by, you know, reunions in that sense as well, because you get to sort of see how somebody may or may not be, you know, the people who are very super academic at the age of 11, and you just think of, you know, they always get top grades, they're destined for greatness, and then you meet them again 10 years later and you discover they dropped out of university. Obviously there may be very good personal reasons for it, but they're not following that path that you just imagined, and you're imagining, you know, almost these imaginary conversations. I remember once meeting up with a chap from school while I was at university, because I did theology, and I think he went to do maths, and I thought he's going to be probably, you know, looking down on, or, you know, because he was in his own sort of mode, and I was doing a subject at school that hardly anyone else did, so it was very much a minority subject. So I, you know, had that sort of sense there of there being some element of inferiority. Quite the opposite. He dropped out of university and didn't know where he was going with his life, and I seemed to be on, and, you know, and you learn more about yourself sometimes from other people's perceptions of, and also the way that people can sometimes say, ah, I knew you were going to do that, or at least I'm surprised that you didn't follow a certain path, and maybe you're doing it now but you weren't doing it then. But there is that interesting link, isn't there, that sometimes other people can see it, but it's almost like ingrained in us, it's organic, it's like who we are, and if we don't express ourselves in that way, and, you know, we may end up doing a job that doesn't allow us to do that, but we will have to find some form of, you know, there has to be a creative outlet somewhere, extracurricular or otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. You'll always come back to it. I guess it's almost like your true north will always pull you back at some point. It's just how long it takes and how much you're going to fight it in the meantime.
And in terms of, you know, media, because obviously we've had a almost an engineered conversation about film, because you were on a program talking about your favorite films. But film or music, did they play a big role in your life growing up?
No.
How interesting.
Not at all. We never particularly watch films. My parents are not really into films or music necessarily. I still don't massively watch films, because for me, although I'm kind of moving out of the video production side and going much more on the coaching side now, but for me, it was never about video, it was never about film, it's all about helping people share their ideas.
Yeah.
Everything, absolutely everything. And that's the thread in my life, is I couldn't share my ideas, or felt like I couldn't, growing up. And a part of that was because, you know, I was a young kid, and this is kind of in terms of the origin story where it started, was being a young kid, being very creative, having lots of ideas, and kind of really feeling them inside, but not being able to express them. Probably because I was young, so you don't have that language to be able to articulate everything you're feeling, and you don't have the language to articulate creativity. That's why we paint, because you can't put a painting into words, right? But at the time, I really took, you know, that feeling of people don't get me was like a really defining thing of, you know, one of those inbuilt things that you're always trying to overcome at every stage in your life. And so that's all my work now, is helping other people be able to share those ideas, because I know what it feels like. But for me, it's very much, it's not just about being able to articulate yourself and the spoken word. It's that if I can't articulate my idea, it's not anything to do with my inability to speak or my inability to express myself. It's all to do with, well, if it's a creative idea, when they start, they're, like I said earlier, they're these unformed things. Like, they're almost like, it's like a baby. Like, when a fetus is developing, it's not fully formed. It doesn't have proper fingers and toes and all this kind of stuff because it's still developing. And I see ideas in the same way. When we first get hit with that strike of, like, that light bulb moment, it's like we feel the energy almost of the idea, but we can't say how many fingers it's going to have and how many toes it's going to have. Yet we try and find the words for it. And when we can't, we go, oh, I'm bad at speaking, or oh, I'm bad at presenting, rather than, no, you just don't know what the idea is young, and therefore their words are not there. And also, you've never spoken those words before, and you've never tried to explain that thing that doesn't exist in the world yet, because you've just come up with it. Therefore, of course you can't.
There's also another angle of resistance, because in order to articulate something, there has to be some kind of outlet or sympathetic voice, unless we speak to ourselves, and I guess diaries can do that. And I've kept a diary since I was young. I used to do radio shows pretty much, I think, for my grandparents when I was young, but I would just sort of sit and just do, you know, what I thought a radio show would be like, and it just, you know, my grandparents were the only people who ever listened to it. But there's something else in terms of a school environment as well, because a lot of my students will go on to be teachers themselves, and often they've been inspired by the teachers who at school made them the, you know, interested in their subject. But also, I can remember teachers when I was at school back I was born in the early 70s, but in the 70s and 80s. And sometimes, you know, looking back, you're thinking, maybe they were in the wrong job, because it felt like they didn't like children. Or there was almost that sense that, you know, that they were, it was almost as though education was about telling people off. It was almost as though, you know, the teachers who were infamous for being strict, and they would sometimes, you know, tell somebody off. And so if you did the wrong thing, if you walked on the wrong side of the stairs, you know, at classes, you know, you'd be humiliated for it. Now, I look now, and when a student of mine is applying to be a teacher, and I have to, you know, I'm writing a reference, they're talking about all the positive reasons as to why they want to be a teacher. And they'll often use words like transformation. And it's about effectively nurturing and facilitating, you know, the seed of something creative in somebody else. But I look back at my school days and think that the thing that we had to work around, the impediment, was that the teachers themselves didn't always seem all that receptive to what we had to tell them. So if imagine that you had this really great idea and you were in some, you know, there was something that you really wanted to do, the teacher may not have been interested, or they might be so busy trying to control a class of other children. You know, somehow there was no outlet for that. So effectively, education was the thing that you went to, and you did what you had to do. But anything else didn't involve, you know, was outside the formal, you know, school context. Was these days, certainly at the grammar school where one of my daughters goes, it's like, you know, if you're interested in ballet, we'll support that. If you're interested in music, you know, we'll help you flourish. It's almost like part of the curriculum that your own talent, the sport or the music that you have, will be embedded in the ethos of the school. And I think that's amazing, but I don't quite recall it being like that, at least not in my experience, you know, four or so decades ago.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. And that's one of the big things, I guess, my mission and my vision of what I want is providing kind of adults, you know, because I, you know, I'm not a teacher, but doing the coaching is providing adults with the space to go, right, you've got something you're trying to work out there. I'm not going to tell you the answer, because I can't tell you your answer, because it's not a what's one plus one. It's a what do you want to do with your life, or what's important to you, or what's your, you know, what's your idea? So I have to just create the safe space in which you can bump into things until you can find what it is and what it isn't. Whereas what school does is just give you information. Yeah. Here's more information. And it's like, you have so much, you have so many answers, but no one teaches you how to ask a question. or set the question. And this is what a lot of people do wrong in when they're presenting in you know, let's take it in a work context. They go, here's the answer. Here's all the answers of all the things I've been doing in the past 3 months or, you know, my project. Yeah, but what? Okay, great, you've given me the answer, but what's the question? I have no idea what the question is as the audience member here. And that's, because I think, because in school we're just information, load up with information, and you never get to ask the important questions.
Yeah, you're right. And it's the whole micro level versus the macro level. That at school, it always felt like sometimes the answer was either right or wrong.
Yeah.
If you got the answer right, you were the smart aleck. If you didn't know the answer, then you always felt, at least there were others in the class who'd be thinking, oh, you got the answer wrong. They, you know, there was always that perception that somehow if you put your hand up and ask, or you were asked directly by the teacher, which would be frightening sometimes, you know, DC, and they say, oh, you know, it was always called by our surname, interesting that. And if we didn't know the answer, then, you know, you'd be aware that everybody would be thinking, gosh, you know, they're not very bright or whatever. But that, in a way, is not the education that I promulgate, and it's not what interests me. So very interestingly, you know, school teaching never, but then again, the school teaching that I'm referring to, that I experienced as a pupil in the 70s and 80s, isn't the sort of the teaching I hope that goes on now. So something has changed in a very positive way, but I'm always interested, and I suppose this is part of the nostalgia thing as well, about some of those teachers who may have been there for 30, 40 years and the shifts that they've witnessed. Because as you say, education can be about saying, what do you want to do? Who do you want to be? And bringing up the best, nurturing something. But that isn't always what the ethos may have been, certainly in my experience. But it was a case of, if you know the right answer, you get it right, you get the marks. And if you get the marks, you get the grade. If you get the grade, you get the certificate. And then you know, you move to the next stage. It was very process driven.
Yeah.
And it was very much micro level, A equals B equals C. You would never think about the end product. It was all about making, you know, it was all about the here and now. It was all about making sure that you got this right so that you can get the grade that you need till the next stage in the process. You weren't really aware of the process itself that this was a part of until you leave school.
Yeah, definitely. You only find it, don't you, once you kind of come out of that, what it is. No, absolutely. And I think that's why maybe that, like you said, that information loading just to get you to pass the test to get to the next stage is probably where I gravitated more to, you know, like design and technology, art, because, and that's something, and I'm, well, I guess, a very big advocate of the value of those subjects, because they're more relevant to real life. In the sense that you go, right, here's the problem, here's the brief, we need to design a thing, right, but what are the problems with the existing things, and how is our thing going to be better, and then working out, building it, testing it, breaking it, throwing it around, coming up with different ideas. Like, for me, that the creative process, and I don't just say creative purely in an artistic sense, I use it from an innovation, creating anything, creating a business, creating a new solution to how you're going to make the tea, I don't know, is what life and business and a lot of jobs are about. But we, and I feel very lucky to have done those technology, those subjects that have a creative process. And that's really what I apply. And that's kind of almost my philosophy for life, really, in a way of, whenever, I guess I'm quite good at learning new things, and I'm very happy to throw myself in at the deep end and not know how to do stuff, because I guess I approach it as a creative process, and I go, right, okay, I don't know what this thing is, I can inquire, I can find things, I can test things out, rather than, I guess, maybe other sorts of subjects that are very much like there's a right and there's a wrong answer, and there's no process to finding the answer.
Do you think the degree harnessed that? Because from what you're saying, because when you mentioned the degree at Loughborough, which was, what was the title again of the degree?
Well, it's now design engineering, but at the time it was product design and manufacture.
Because it sounds like, what you're describing sounds like, I can see, it seems to me that the work that you're doing now is clearly an offshoot of that, because effectively it's about creating or formulating or framing a product and knowing what to do with it. You're talking, but that may not match your school educational experience, or maybe it does.
So you're absolutely right. For example, video production is the same process. Whether you're designing you know, Dyson Hoover or a video, it's the same process. It's just you've got a different audience, you've got different tools, you've got a different brief, but it's the same process. I would say my degree didn't form that. I think it was formed in school, design and technology at school, probably even before that. Like, I was painting, you know, and drawing and creating things and making up obstacle courses and all sorts of stuff from a young age. So I think I just, that's naturally how I think, and I just was lucky enough to find those subjects, or, you know, be allowed to kind of follow those subjects, really. And you're absolutely right, they're I think they're very applicable. And I it's the same thing from an entrepreneurial point of view, and kind of setting up and building a business and talking to other people about their businesses. And yeah, it's the whole lot. And I guess you could say, yeah, you know, doing that at university, just it wasn't the time when it was created. It was just solidified. It was more of the same and solidifying it. But the difference that came at uni, and I'm in hindsight, I'm saying it came at uni, but I think maybe it was sparked, and I only realised it in forthcoming years, was the next element of that being like, okay, you can design and you can build something, but if you can't communicate it, no one's going to use it. And it was like, that was the next step. And I remember having this, just experience or kind of insight of like, we're designing all of these things and then we try and sell them. And it's like, we design first and then we communicate, rather than we should be communicating them at the same time that we design them, and that those two things should go parallel rather than one after the other. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but yeah, just experiences of like my peers and them just not being able to kind of, I guess, step back from their pieces and kind of question, right, why are we doing this? Who are the people we're serving with this? And it's being able to really scrutinise the brief.
In higher education, I think probably around, I'd say 2008 or 9, the word impact came in, and a lot of people were a bit wrong-footed by this, because suddenly it wasn't about having a great idea, you know, writing a book on something that nobody else has written on. It was about the impact of that. In other words, if it's not going to reach somebody, then why are you doing it? And that also, I think, for me, I mean, in a way, actually, I saw it as a very positive thing, because I suppose there was always a part of me that thought, well, if you're studying something, there has to be some sort of utility to it. It's almost the justification. You know, I had that. I remember once, but I think it was at a wedding when I was young, and I just got a degree in theology, and somebody said, effectively, what does that mean? What is theology? And what's the point? So suddenly you can do a 3-year degree, write all those essays, participate in classes, or perhaps not so much, because I suppose there was a shyer version of me that existed then. And you do all these erudite things, and you do all the things you're told to do by the deadlines that you're given, this enormous skill set. You've produced this body of work, essays every 2 weeks, whatever it was. And then somebody asks you a question, what is that and why did you do it? And you're thinking, I don't know the answer to that. Because I think now we would ask that question. In fact, at the very beginning, we would say to the students, you know, why are you here? Why did you choose to do this? Whereas back then, it was almost a case of you doing this subject, so immediately we'll be thrown into the minutiae of that subject in its historical, cultural context. Whereas I think these days, the starting point would be, what's the point to this? Is it going to get you a job? And I think that's why arts and humanities, and in my own subject in religious studies, has not done too well in recent years. Because suddenly, no matter how important the subjects are in their own right, effectively, it comes down to, that's all great, but what are you going to do with it, and how are you going to make money from doing that? When I went to uni in the early 90s, I don't think it ever even occurred to me that there was a correlation between doing that degree and how much I might earn. It was almost a case of, well, we're doing this because it's important in its own sake. We were not thinking employability wise.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's one of the obvious shifts.
Yeah, definitely. It always comes down to the why, doesn't it? And that's the other time where we need that safe space to be able to explore those things, because no one else can give us our answer. We have to find it. But we often don't have time, because it's like, here's more information. Just keep learning more stuff and doing more things, rather than, yeah, but why?
Yeah.
Why this thing, not that thing? Because you can do, and I'm not always very good at practicing it, but my dad said to me, he was like, you can You can do anything you want, but you can't do everything. And this is a more recent thing he said to me. And I've always tried to do everything because, you know, when I apply myself, you can do anything, but you can't do everything. And that's where your why starts to come in, doesn't it?
Yeah, but also, you see, there's another angle, because if I'm doing a radio show and it's not going out to the audience, it may be that an engineer is needed who's able to press the various buttons, which is way outside my area of competence. Or if I'm giving a lecture and for some reason the technology's not working and I need to use a PowerPoint or something, there's a point where I can know how this assists me. I can't do a radio show unless the transmitter's working and so on. But in a way, that's not my immediate area of concern. All I need to know is that this is going out and that I'm communicating something and I'm doing it in a way that is profitable. But sometimes, of course, we all have to acknowledge our strengths and limitations, and sometimes just think, well, yeah, you know, somebody, you know, I've noticed it in the TV world as well. There are lots of introverts. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised at that. I'd often be with the most amazing crew who were technically brilliant, second to none, and yet the last thing they'd ever want to do is go anywhere near a camera. They'd be happy behind the camera, but never in front of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I wouldn't have a clue what was going on behind the camera, but I'd want to be in front of the camera. And it's just and that was interesting because, you know, in a way, it's a naive way of looking at it, but just that assumption that if somebody's doing something in media or in radio or in TV, that by definition, they're going to be people who have that urge to project, to disseminate, you know, that almost that there's an extrovert side. But often the best people can be introverts because they know how the thing works and they're good, sensible people almost like behind the scenes. But that doesn't mean to say that they want to jump out and do that in front of the camera. So it's interesting sometimes that we have our strengths, but we do it in a community of people who we all nurture each other. So sometimes one side thing, you know, there are various things to do. When it comes to maths or finance, it's not my strong area. I think I'm at a point in my life now where I look at it and say, well, it's fine that it's like that. Because, you know, if you're at school, you know, you want to be good at maths and English and music and drama and sciences and history and geography. Yeah. But, you know, and you might get some wonderful A-level or GCSE grades in a range of subjects. But when you get a bit older, you look back and you think, well, I don't really need to know that, because there are some things that you know that if you can do everything, then other people who have a talent in an area are not being utilised. So yeah. It's about, you know, having that breadth, but also knowing that we can play to our strengths when we sort of plunge in and do the thing that we know best and do it well. And if we all do that, then we will all function very well together.
Yeah. And I think a lot of, you know, I feel it, you know, it's not a regret, but one of those things, I'd be interested to see what my life would be like if I hadn't been good at so much of a range of subjects, because I was a hard worker, right? So I did well in all of my subjects because I worked hard at them. But also that makes it a lot harder to make a decision about which route you're going to go down as one challenge. But then also, as you were saying, you know, we can't do it all, and there's other, we work in teams, things only exist in teams. But when you're somebody who tries to do it all yourself, inevitably you can't, and you go a lot slower and all this sort of thing. So, and I, you know, where I'm stepping back from the video production to focus on the kind of media coaching side. So like, that's what I've wanted to do since I went freelance. And I think it's probably, you know, I remember in art classes spending my whole time talking to people about their ideas and their projects. It's what I've wanted to do ever since, forever. But I got distracted, distracted in inverted commas, but, you know, ended up doing video production and all these kind of different things, rather than just focusing on the thing I wanted to do, because I could do them and I had a kind of okay amount, I was competent at doing them and you could get by. But actually, if I'd been crap at the other things, I would have got to where I am, feel where I am now a lot sooner.
Yeah, because often, and it's back to that analogy I used earlier of somebody at school who was good at maths, and because I wasn't, I always felt very, you know, in their company, you'd be aware of this disconnect in what they could do and you can do. What perhaps I didn't do is think that there may have been things that I could do and which it never occurred to me that they might be particular strengths that they didn't have. You know, one thing I could always do was performance, but I hardly ever used it. It was almost like, you know, that there was probably a more introverted side of me that in subsequent years has been displaced by a more extrovert side. But sometimes we judge ourselves by various paradigms, which might be, the, you know, I mentioned the word impact earlier, but they're often educationally a sort of sense of, if you are good at remembering things, for example, you know, you might not know very much about aeroplane rivets, but if you can remember it and learn it, and in the course of an exam you're able to put all that recollection, that memory, into practice, then you get a good mark. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, 2 months, let alone 2 decades later, you might have written this amazing essay or this piece or this presentation on a subject that you have no idea what it means.
Yeah.
So you're learning it for the purposes, not because you embody it, but because it's a strategic thing. Yeah. And I think that is the way that... So in a way, you may not yourself be an educator in the sense of a formal, you're not a teacher, but actually you're doing more education in what you're doing than the formal educational paradigm that I was familiar with growing up 40-odd years ago.
Yeah, I think, and you know, education comes in lots of different forms, yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. And lots of different styles.
Yeah. Now, as we start to wrap up, obviously nostalgia is the sort of framework of that whole sort of, you know, looking back on your life. Would you say, and this is linked to the sliding doors moment that I touched on earlier, but there's that whole question, isn't there, about whether we can learn from, maybe even see negative experiences as being things we can draw on. I suppose it's a way of really saying, can you be nostalgic even about those negative experiences, particularly if you might, over the course of time, have become a better person because something didn't go the way it should have done. It may be awful. You may have experienced something that, you know, at the time was shameful, embarrassing, awkward, humiliating. And then all those late decades on, you think, yeah, having done that, I'm a stronger person because of it. At the time, it was a necessary, you know, it was a tragedy, it was an evil, it was upsetting. But now you look back and think, yeah, it made me who I am now. Is that something that you can relate to?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like those key examples. I guess there is one very big example at the table, but I guess it feels like it's not necessarily putting me on the course I wanted, but it stopped me doing something that I didn't want to be doing anymore, really, which was basically the week after I finished uni, the week before I was about to graduate, I broke my kneecap wakeboarding. So it was like a really bad injury and all that kind of stuff. And basically what it was, looking back and in hindsight and kind of, you know, really looking at where I was in the headspace kind of at the time, I think what it was, you know, I didn't cause the injury, but I didn't want to be doing wakeboarding. I was doing wakeboarding a lot and I was doing it like semi-professionally, like not being paid, but, you know, sponsored kit and stuff. Which was kind of my key sport at university. And I didn't want to be doing it anymore because I was doing well, I was competing, but I was putting all this pressure on myself to continue to keep performing. And therefore you have to take bigger and bigger risks. And basically I stopped enjoying it because I'd gone from, oh, this is fun, I can, you know, it's like I'd snowboarded, so it was like snowboarding, but in water, so you can throw yourself off jumps and go in head first and it doesn't matter because you're landing in water. And that's great, and that's where I'm great, is learning things for the first time, because like I said earlier, I'm willing to look silly and throw myself off things and give it a go and learn by doing. But as I get more and more into something, the more that disappears, that the trial and error disappears, the more that I have to get it right and I have to keep performing, kicks in. And therefore you don't enjoy it, because for me that's not life, where you're like, you must do this and you must deliver and you must be right and you must perform. So I wanted to get out. I didn't want to wakeboard anymore, but I didn't have the guts, but I didn't allow myself, my head, to listen to my heart and listen to my gut saying that. And so it was kind of like a silly injury that I kind of, like I said, I didn't cause it, but it was probably, I left myself open to it, I guess you could say.
But also the timing of that. So a week, so how did that all work out for you in the end? I mean, I'm hoping, particularly because Loughborough is obviously a sports-based university, but I'm hoping that they were able to accommodate your injury rather than say, oh, tough. Yeah.
No, I got to graduation with my full leg in plaster. On crutches. So yeah, I just went up on stage to collect my degree on crutches. Yeah. Pictures of me with like my course mates, kind of like, I'm like stretched out with my leg out and all this kind of stuff. From that point of view, I still graduated and everything. The other thing that was also going on at that moment. Not only did I want to get out the wakeboarding, but also I, like I said, I just finished my degree and I didn't, the classic, you know, academic, working hard, you know what you're going to do, right? You work hard to get your GCSEs and then you get your A-levels and then you go to university. And I didn't have a clue what I was going to do afterwards because it was the classic, I've done this degree, but I don't know what I want to do with my life. And so basically what it did is it gave me, you know, like 9 months a year of not having to really fully engage with that, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Because I was able to almost go backwards and be like, okay, well, first I've got to recover. And I had to go home because I couldn't drive, couldn't, you know, work because I couldn't go anywhere. So I just kind of had to, yeah, go back home and live back home when I got back. And yeah, it was like a stop on life and progression, really, until that was sorted. So it was like, take myself backwards. Because I'm not ready to go forwards.
That comes up a lot in previous interviews I've done when somebody has gone, because I was at a university in West Wales in Lampeter, and a lot of people, certainly in those days, would literally travel from the other end of the country. So you'd have students from Scotland, from the northeast of England, you know, it wasn't just a geographical thing. You know, so effectively, going to university really was a culture shift. But the going back, back to their hometowns, or maybe, for example, returning to a part-time job, maybe in a pub, or, you know, and suddenly the conversations they were having. So they'd been away, and I remember one interview I did, and the former student of mine, as she was saying that she remembered having gone away and learned what she did, and was then aware that there were some people who hadn't moved at all, hadn't moved on at all, and she had all these experiences. But there were some people and she thought, gosh, you know, how lucky, how privileged she was to at least have had the opportunity, whatever the future has in store, at least to have, for a period in her life, done something differently in a different place and space. And I think there's an element, and I've done that, of eulogising that. I mean, if I look back at diary entries, you can think how stressed you were and how uncomfortable or awkward, or if the accommodation has fallen through for the next year, or if you're worried about your performance on a particular essay or exam. All of the things are going on. But looking back, of course, it's easy to sort of say, yeah, it was all great. You know, there's that composite. We all do that, don't we? You look at the events from a period and you put them all together as if they all happened on the same day. You're almost like bracketing things out. You're almost like, you know, what is the essence of that experience? Some people will never go back. Some people like me couldn't go back for, I think in my case, it was about 15 or more years. I'd spent 10 years in the place I stayed to do other degrees. And then felt able to go back because I had a clearer sense of what my relationship was with that place. While I was there, I was, I think, similar to what you were saying, there's that sense that you don't quite know where you're going to, what you're going to do with it. And for that reason, then it takes a lot more effort to try and see how you can function outside of that environment and what, and whether it was a good thing or a bad thing that you chose that path after all. Because I can look back now and say that, yeah, you know, it's a different world. I've never left higher education in the sense of the job that I've had, but I can look back now and almost reconnect with that younger self. And it's that younger self at the age of 18 who went to university that I'm a lot closer to now in many ways, because I always knew I wanted to do something in media and radio, but it's almost as though I did the absolute opposite of what I should have done. If I wanted to work in radio, why did I go to a university in West Wales where there was no radio opportunity, far away from a city, did a PhD on film, and yet there was no cinema in the town. So it was almost like I was doing the absolute opposite of all I wanted to do, and had a very good career in higher education, in university. But it was never quite what I wanted to do. But I found a way of doing it through the job, through the podcast, through some of the TV ventures I've had, all through my work. So there is that sense almost that you will do, it's almost that you have to do what you are meant to do. But the journey there, you used the word, I think, meandering earlier on, and I certainly used the word circuitous. We get there in the end. And when you realise that, or you realise that it might actually be happening, it's actually very satisfying, but almost comical, because you think, well, why did it take 30 years? Well, you know, couldn't I have just done that after two or three?
Yeah. You do those things. You do what you end up doing, what you were meant to be doing, in spite of yourself and in spite of the decisions you make. And it's just how much resistance and how much of a fight you're going to put up to it versus, sometimes those big knocks that make you realise, yeah, I got to stop fighting it now and buckle up and just do it, because it's often scary doing the things you really want to do in case you fail.
And in terms of your relationship with friends, your peers, people you went to school with, because obviously you're from Folkestone, you're in Folkestone now. Is there a different sort of relationship? Because some of them would have stayed, others would have gone away and maybe stayed away, and maybe you connect through various, you know, through virtual means or through social media, if not in person. But have you found over the years that you're often doing that whole reassessment, like you used to be defined in a certain way, but your relationship changes and the way that you see yourself, the way that people see you, the way that you know, what you project onto them, has, in terms of being from Folkestone, living in Folkestone now, what's your relationship with place?
I would say I'm probably not, my gut would be to say I don't have a huge relationship with place. I think having my own space is very important, because I think I absorb a lot of what other people think and feel, and that, and I love that because that's what connects me with them, but also it can cloud my own thinking. So having my own space is important. But where I am location wise, it doesn't stand out, and not something I could speak to, I guess. But going back to, I guess, some of the stuff you were saying there around, you know, I guess those phases in our lives, I guess I'd say mine is more identities I've had at that time and who I've been at that time. So, you know, when I was at university, I was a wakeboarder, and like, I thought I might go and do that profession and that would be my career. And when I was at school, I was an artist, and like, I saw myself as an artist. You know, when I've done film, it's been like, right, okay, I'm an entrepreneur, filmmaker type thing. So these roles that we play, I think, have been more of that. And I tend to have a window. It seems to be, you know, three to four to five years is normally the window of something. And then it's like shifting identity, really. And it's not sometimes it can maybe sound a bit fickle, like we were going back to the persona, but it's not. It's right, this is what's important to me at this time. And I think it's maybe like you were saying about place and how place can ground you, but it's who I see myself to be in that. There was a book that I read that was very key on the subject of identity for me, called The Dice Man. And it's a fiction, and it's quite extreme in the sense that it kind of goes to quite over the top lengths. But I really got a lot of stuff personally from it, because it basically the idea is that a guy is bored with his life, and he on a whim decides to like kind of throw a dice. If this happens, or if it's evens, I'll do this. If it's odds, I'll do that. And then he starts to use the dice as a way of exploring parts of himself that he didn't let out, because, you know, he's in his 50s or whatever, and he's become very set in his ways. It was a way of allowing those different parts of ourselves out. And I read it as a teenager. And really, that identity piece was really powerful for me, because, as I mentioned earlier on, I was, my subjects, I was like, okay, I'm an artist, but I'm also a jock, as it were, because I was really sporty. And I went to a girls' school, but, you know, it was like I was part of the sporty group and we were the sporty ones. But I was also good at maths, so I was like, I also saw myself as a bit of a geek, but I also saw myself, I could be very social and that kind of thing. And that was really, really confusing for me as a teenager, when everyone else is one thing and I feel like I'm constantly being these different things. And that book allowed me to go, yeah, I'm different things. And I can be my different identities. And it's not that I'm faking it at any one moment. It's just I can be an extrovert. I can be an introvert. I can be an artist. I can be a geek. And it's okay for me to be all of these different expressions of myself. And so when I say I've had phases, it's been like, yeah, I'm going to go all in on this. I'm going to go all in on the wakeboarding. And it was like all my life and all the stuff. I think, and, you know, my dissertation was on like knee braces for wakeboarding, all this sort of thing. And then it was like, okay, yeah, I've explored that self. And I'm ready to look at another self that I can be. So, yeah, that's more significant for me than self is more identity, more than place.
Yeah. And actually related to that, I mean, do you have things like diaries or records of, I mean, obviously you have maybe those essays or equivalent, you know, projects that you were working on, but do you ever return to those? Are you aware of what you wrote about yourself at the time? Do you ever find, I mean, obviously you regularly do social media posts. But you presumably wouldn't have had the outlet to do that back when you were at school, for example. So was there a different means of expression then that may be functionally the same as what you're doing now professionally?
Not so much in a spoken way. The original outlet for me was painting and art. I moved a couple of months back, and that was a big moment because I threw away majority of my paintings, which, you know, my poor mum had them stored in her cellar, and she was like, you know, no one's ever going to do anything with them, but also I don't want to throw them away. So that was a big break from that, really. I'd never really go back and look at, because I will often, I guess I'm quite good at asking myself the questions to understand myself where I felt like I haven't been able to. So, but I'd never read them back because they're streams of consciousness and they're for me in the moment, and then they're binned. I don't really watch my videos back, my old videos. Like, I watch them in the moment, but I don't watch old ones because...
Because you've always got a new one to put out in that sense. Yeah.
And also it's being able, the creation of those things, be it a piece of art or a video or a vlog, I use it. It's not about the output. It's that medium creates the opportunity to go back to have the process to be like, right, I want an outlet to be able to, I want to express something, not to express it and have other people understand it, but for me to understand it. And that's what, for me, the creative process is I've got an idea. I have no idea what this idea is, and I have no idea how to articulate it. So I need a process, and the process of creating it enables me to work out what it is, rather than I'm creating something to educate others. And it's a bit like the saying about, like, if you want to know if you really know a subject, teach. Teach it to someone else. And so there's a little bit of that, and that's what my...
And actually, that's why sometimes listening back or reading back on something is helpful, because I found that in some contexts, you know, you can stutter and stammer and find it very difficult to articulate something. In, you know, like the time when somebody said to me, "So, what is theology? Why did you do it?" And suddenly you give some ridiculously vague answer. You've just done this 3-year degree and done well at it, but you can't explain why you did it. And that worried me at the time. Mm. Like, that should be the obvious thing. You know, my passion should answer that question. But in another context, I'll listen back to something I've done on the radio and I think, gosh, this sounds fluid. It sounds like I know what I'm talking about. And I think that sometimes it's the way that, you know, I suppose a good example would be, in one context, you can, if you're giving a presentation, I can imagine that you would have excelled in school at all that sort of thing, because...
I was terrible.
Were you? So So in a way, so you use that as the springboard, because in that sort of context, you know what you have to do and you can do it or not. But I used to find that it was those conversations on a bus, when somebody might, you'd be sitting next to it could be a random stranger, or it could be somebody who vaguely knows you, but who says, "Oh, so you're doing a PhD and, you know, what you're looking at," and then they'll ask you very obvious questions like, "So are you looking at this film or that film, or why are you looking at this, what's your reason for doing that, are you a believer, are you, you know," suddenly all these questions you're thinking, these are like red flags, you know, these are questions I really, it's the elephant in the room in many cases, the questions I would never ask these questions to my students. But if you're at the supermarket checkout, or if you're on a bus, then sometimes, of course, you don't have the same sort of control as to where the conversation will lead.
Yeah.
And I find those the hardest questions. I can articulate myself in a Viva situation. I can articulate on the radio, but I can come unstuck if I'm in a McDonald's restaurant, as happened to me once, actually, when I was with my children. And somebody said, you do stuff with religion. Which church do you go to? Why don't you go to church? Do you want to come to my church? And I was just thinking, all of these questions, I wish I didn't answer them. And yet, in another context, I'm the person who is associated with something to do with the dissemination of religion or faith or spirituality or theology. So it's interesting that outside of that context, you mentioned place earlier, and whether we're defined by place, but, you know, sometimes we can be taken out of one social situation and find it much harder to articulate something that we want to say than we might have done in another. So often we learn from rereading or relearning or rehearing what we've put out, just to know almost that we can do it. And if we did it then, no reason why we can't do it again.
Yeah. And then you hear it as a outsider as well, rather than as the speaker. And you know, what they always say, "Oh, think about your audience." It's like, but you can't while you're speaking because you are in your head.
Yeah. In a way, you are your own audience in that sense. As you're speaking, you're aware that people will be thinking, "He's going on too much, or he's saying too much, or he should play a record, or whatever it might be."
Yeah, and that is why a lot of people struggle with communication. You know, like I said, media presentations is because they're running that in their head, that critique or the audience while they're speaking at the same time, and you can't do that. And that's the big, I guess, thing that I feel that I'm quite good at is I can turn off the little voice in my head that critiques me while I'm in the process, because there's no point. Why say, oh, that was a stupid thing to say? Because then you're just going to more likely to say something more stupid, or you're then not listening to what the next question is. So turning that off while you're in the moment, but that's completely different from listening to yourself back and going, oh, okay, that was good, that was not, or okay, that was clearly the moment where I got stuck in my head and therefore I wasn't present and in the moment.
Yeah. Well, I've got one more question for you, Leo. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Forward, definitely. Yeah. I've always been a... And I think that's why I can be kind of quite like a striving person. Sometimes I wish I could just chill out a bit more. Because for me, it's always been about creation. Like, what do I create? And, you know, and... But I'm also, I'm second guessing myself here now. I guess I'm quite good at reflecting and learning, questioning myself and exploring and that personal journey. But from an inward point of view, self-reflection. But from an outward point of view, it's all about moving.
And I have to say that's a brilliant answer, because you answered without hesitation, without knowing I was going to ask that. Often when I do that, that's the one question we've had a really fluid conversation for the last hour. And then there's a pause. Somebody goes, oh, I don't know, let me think about that. And often I have to edit that because sometimes there might be like a 10-second pause. A brilliant answer afterwards. But you went straight into that. So you are completely switched on in terms of your own direction of travel. Leo, wonderful to meet you again. Thank you ever so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much.